This is the office hours 8 session, I believe, for Principles of Economics. And we just, as usual on these ones, we've only got a few people signed in right now. So, Brad, right now, do you have any burning questions you have for me? Yeah, that's totally fine, Brad, if you want to do that. So Brad's asking a question related to a book I wrote with Carlos Lara called How Privatized Banking Really Works. So yeah, I mean, I'll give the disclaimer that that's more of a, we take some Austrian ideas and then apply it to certain investment strategies. So just the disclaimer, the Mises Institute does not endorse that stuff necessarily. I mean, but it's these office hours, people are asking me questions, and then I guess I can answer that. Okay, Brad says, last week you discussed fractional reserve banking. You deal with this in your book on privatized banking. In your book, you don't discuss how FDIC is bankrupt, having turned their capital into IOUs in the same way as a Social Security Trust Fund. It is easy to find articles and people discussing the Social Security Trust Fund being void of assets. How come very few people discuss the insolvency of FDIC? Is it because of SEC rules and the government controlling what is said about FDIC? Is it because politicians think the American public would be more shocked about FDIC than Social Security? Okay, well, well, actually, it doesn't really talk about my book too much, since you're saying I don't discuss this in my book, so this is fine. Let's see. So let me just make sure everyone who's listening to this recording knows what I'm talking about or what we're talking about. So FDIC is the, was it stand for Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation? I think that's what the acronym is. That is the institution established in the 30s during a New Deal to sort of guarantee your checking account balances. So even if your commercial bank fails and you had a checking account with, you know, $2,000 in there, then this government agency called FDIC is going to make you whole. So the philosophy there, the ostensible purpose, is to make depositors not get worried about the solvency of their own commercial bank. So they're not afraid that, if my bank goes down, I'm going to lose all my money. And so then if people start worrying about that, they start lining up trying to take their money out. So that's what causes a bank runner. That's what a bank run is, if a bunch of people are trying to take out their money. So the point is that the idea is that if you have this government guarantee, then people don't panic, they don't line up to take their money out, and then everything's fine, right? So the standard view is there's nothing wrong with the nature of fractional reserve banking, with the way our banking system works. The fact that the bank doesn't have everyone's money sitting in the vault, but it's lent out most of it, people say that's not the problem. The problem is if people panic and try to take it all out. So we got to just do something to diffuse that possible snag in this wonderful system we have. And of course, people like Murray Rothbard say, no, it's a rotten system. If you have to try to bribe and cajole and trick people into not taking out their money, then it's not a very stable system, is it? All right, so now Brad's saying that FDIC is bankrupt in the same way that Social Security is, because that there are just IOUs sitting in FDIC. So, Brad, I mean, to be honest with you, I didn't know that. So you're saying if FDIC is claiming that on paper they have such and such in assets, I don't even know what they're claiming they have in assets, you're saying those assets are really just treasury bonds? And so really, that's not really, that money's been spent. Is that what you're getting at? What, while you're answering that, Brad, let me explain it in the context of Social Security, where I'm on sure footing. So as far as Social Security goes, so that of course is the old age retirement program that's, and it's some other related programs too, where people pay in. So for Social Security, people pay in their Social Security taxes is the employer and employee share. And in theory, that's supposed to be a distinct segregated fund. That is just supposed to – the taxes you pay on Social Security are just supposed to be dedicated to building up the Social Security Trust Fund to pay current retirees and, you know, other beneficiaries like widows and stuff like that. And then if more gets paid in a given year than gets paid out, that's supposed to accumulate and be saved to then fund future things. Okay, so Brad had asked about FDIC and isn't it analogous to Social Security. So I think a lot of people understand how Social Security works. Workers and their employers paying a lot out of each paycheck, and so that funds that period's outgoing Social Security checks. And then if there's an excess, which there was for a long time from the early 80s until last year, I think, there was always a surplus. So the workers collectively paid more in Social Security taxes than that year's Social Security beneficiaries got from the federal government. And so that difference, in theory, was supposed to build up what was called a Social Security Trust Fund. But of course, what happened is the federal government just spent that money. And so the Social Security Trust Fund just started accumulating pieces of paper issued by the Treasury saying, you know, basically IOUs. So just like, you know, a corporation, if you have Treasury bonds that are promises from the federal government to pay you, you would count that as an asset, right? Because, you know, just like if you buy a bond from a corporation or you buy a bond from the government, that's an asset. Okay, so in one sense, you can say in terms of the accounting, well, yeah, sure, the Social Security Trust Fund's sitting there. It's got $1 trillion in bonds or whatever the number is right now. But in another important sense, you can see that, well, no, I mean, if it's just, if you're thinking of the government as a unified financial entity, it doesn't, you know, reassure the taxpayers to say, well, don't worry, guys, it's true. You know, next year Social Security's got to, or this year even, Social Security's paying out more than the workers are paying in. But don't worry, we have a bunch of money sitting in the trust fund, and Social Security actually won't go broke until 2037 or whatever the number is. But that's a little bit misleading, because how is the government going to pay off those treasuries? Just by taxing people. Okay, so the way I would put it in my articles, try to get people to see why it's weird in this context is, look, so I say, suppose an intern took all those IOUs in the Social Security Trust Fund and tripped on the carpet and dropped them in a paper shredder, right? I mean, I'm exaggerating, because obviously you couldn't be physically carrying that many IOUs, and they're probably electronic anyway, but you get the idea. That actually that wouldn't do anything to the federal government as a whole. Yeah, the trust fund just would have lost $1 trillion+ in assets, but then the national debt would have gone down by the same amount. Okay, and so the taxpayers would now be on the hook for less taxes, because now the outstanding national debt, you know, the total figure would be that much lower. But of course, now the trust fund would be, you know, in the red by that much more. So in terms of, you're just thinking of it in terms of the entire country and all the taxpayers and all the retirees as one solid group, it would be perfectly offsetting. Right? So that's the sense in which people say the trust fund is a gimmick. So what Brad is asking is, can't you say the same thing about FDIC? So let me, okay, so I can't independently confirm this, but it makes perfect sense to me that Brad is saying this. What FDIC does, how it operates, I mean, I know that this is how it operates, but I wasn't sure before Brad's question of what they did with their assets, but this makes sense. This is the kind of thing the government would do, so I have no reason to doubt what Brad's saying. So FDIC is, in theory, an insurance corporation, and it's got all the nation's commercial banks as clients, if you will, but they're mandatory. And so in order to deal with this problem of a bank run, what FDIC does is it says to all the member banks, you have to pay us insurance premiums, right? That you're paying us insurance in case any of you become insolvent, and then we have to come in and seize you. And to, you know, we are pledging to make your depositors whole. And so it used to be up to $100,000 in checking accounts, and now, do you know, Brad, off the top of your head, is it like $250,000? They bumped up the numbers during the financial crisis to reassure people. And so I think, off the top of my head, I think right now it's $250,000. They insure checking accounts up to that amount. But you can have multiple checking accounts too. So in principle, even the same household, the taxpayers could be on the hook for, you know, $1 million if the household had a bunch of different checking accounts in different banks. Okay, yeah, $250,000 right now. But again, that's per checking account. That's not per person. So again, the ostensible reason for that of having FDIC is to make people not have the incentive to go run to their bank and try to take their money out, because then that's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, and the system will crash if that starts happening. But where does the government get the money to do that? They don't want it to just be this outstanding liability of the taxpayers, right? And so instead of doing that, they say, we're going to make it like an insurance program. So it's FDIC, I think Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. I'm pretty sure that's what that stands for. So why don't I look that up instead of me continually saying something might be wrong, since I've got the entire internet at my disposal while I'm talking. So FDIC, yeah, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. I was pretty sure that's what that meant, but I didn't want to be repeating a falsehood. Okay, so that's so what they do is they charge insurance premiums to the banks. Presumably they're related to their, you know, the amount of deposits they have. I don't know the exact formula they use. And so this FDIC then every year or every month, whatever the term is, takes in a bunch of, you know, all kinds of premium payments. And then if a bank fails and they have to come in and shut down a bank and it lost money, you know, so the bank, remember, the customers make their deposits and the bank can go do reckless stuff with the money. That occasionally happens. And so then if the bank makes a bunch of bad investments and then becomes insolvent, FDIC comes in and shuts them down, and let's say, and it looks at the books, and if, you know, if the bank's assets at that point are only worth $2 million and the customers in terms of their checking account balances thought they had $2.4 million, well, uh-oh, there's a $400,000 discrepancy, and so now FDIC kicks in the $400,000 to make those customers whole so that nobody, so the idea is they don't want any American tax or any American citizen worried about his or her bank account going down in value because the bank failed. And so that way, now people aren't worrying about that. So what Brad is saying is that the FDIC is just as fraudulent as a Social Security trust fund. That in a given year, if banks pay in more in insurance premiums than FDIC needs to pay out in terms of making depositors whole who had their accounts in a bank that failed, then in theory they should be doing something with it. They should be saving that money for a rainy day in case there's, you know, a spate of bank failures down the road. But no, the federal government just spends that money on bridges or bombs or welfare payments, whatever, and then just puts in some IOUs and FDIC's trust fund. So like I say, I cannot independently confirm that that's what's happening, but that makes total sense to me that that is what would be happening. And you're right, Brad, if we're going to say that the Social Security Trust Fund is a sham, and we spend a lot of time talking about that, then why don't we say the same thing for FDIC? You ask, is it because of SEC rules? Well, I don't know. I mean, that might be restraining. Like, that wouldn't stop me. I doubt I could get in trouble. I mean, maybe legally I could, but I doubt they would bother with small potatoes like me. I mean, the reason I haven't been talking about it is just never even occurred to me, to be frank with you. For people listening to this, what Brad is referring to is you can be prosecuted for causing a bank run, right? So, like, if I just start, like, if the Wall Street Journal runs a news story printing, you know, anonymous claims that a particular bank had made a bunch of dodgy investments and it causes a bank run, and especially if it turned out that the story wasn't well documented, like if the claims weren't really true, well, then the Wall Street Journal could be sued. All right, I don't know what the exact charge would be, but you're not supposed to spread rumors that could cause a bank run. All right, so So that's what Brad is asking, if that the threat of such litigation or you know, official punishment might be why people aren't talking more about this. So yeah, that could be part of it, especially people who are more tied into the financial community. But I think the main reason most people talk more about the Social Security Trust Fund versus FDIC is that the Social Security Trust Fund's bigger. You know, that's a bigger deal. People, you know, there's a lot more at stake with Social Security, but and also just a lot of people don't really even know how FDIC works. Okay, Brad says this was discussed in Goyette's book, The Dollar Meltdown. There's also a congressional hearing record I'll send you, which discusses this in 2001. Okay, yeah, I'm familiar with. I mean, I know of Goyette's book, but I haven't read it. But that's interesting. I do know. I mean, Doug French gave a really scary talk a few months ago, and he was using various statistical evidence. I don't remember the exact figures he used, but he made a convincing case that FDIC right now must be intentionally closing banks at a very slow pace. In other words, like looking at various sources and looking at how many bank closings there were before the financial crisis, and then like what analysts were predicting, you know, coming into the crisis as more and more information became available about how many failures there would be in, you know, early 2010, late 2010, early 2011, compared to what we've actually been seeing. You know, one interpretation is, oh, look at the economy is much better than people realized, and there were a bunch of alarmists. But Doug French's interpretation was, no, FDIC is broke, and if they actually were doing their job as they were supposed to and shutting down all these banks that were insolvent, then they would run out of money. And so that's why they're not shutting down more banks, is because they don't have the means right now to be able to make all those depositors whole, and they don't want that to be obvious, so they're just letting these insolvent banks continue in operation. What is undisputable, this clearly did happen, is FDIC was basically running out of money. I don't remember. I think this was like 18 months ago. I'm off a little bit on the timeline, perhaps. But you know, after the financial crisis was well underway, FDIC was in serious trouble, and so they charged 2 or 3 years worth of future premiums immediately to the banks to get their reserves back up. Right, so they like pre-charge for a bunch of future services, and then like it's possible right now that they're still have already burned through that money, and they've already in a sense charged their customers for the next few years. Okay, Ed Farr says, I just read Danny's Overt and Covert Socialism. Wonderful piece of work. The thesis is that every economy moves towards socialism or capitalism. No third option. My question, which of the two is the traditional medieval absolute monarchy? Well, I'm not sure. Let me think about that for a second. Let me, again, put this in context. And again, the standard disclaimer for people who are taking the class and listening to this recording, you are not responsible for this material, but if these people show up in office hours, I'm going to answer their questions. So what Ed's referring to here is, I haven't read this piece, Overt and Covert Socialism, I don't think, but more generally, I mean, Mises has this idea that there's no third way, that you either, you know, a society either embraces a market economy or it goes the path of full-blown socialism, and that you're fooling yourself if you think you can have a stable government structure that intervenes in markets, you know, tries to achieve certain social outcomes and things like that, but doesn't continually move towards socialism. And Mises' argument is that there's unintended consequences, at least from the point of view of the citizens supporting the program. I mean, the politicians might know full well what they're doing. But like if you, like Mises, one of his standard examples is he says, suppose the government wants to make milk more affordable for poor mothers, right? So they come along and say, oh my gosh, milk is too expensive. How could anybody, you know, struggling young mother trying to feed her kids, maybe, you know, she's a widow or the husband left her or something, and she's got a bunch of young kids. She can't possibly afford this. That's unconscionable. Let's pass a law making milk 20% cheaper. All right, so we're putting a price ceiling on milk set 20% below what right now is the market clearing level. Well, the government can do that, and it can enforce it very strongly, but what does that do? That now is the stuff we discussed in this class a few weeks ago. That's going to lead to a shortage. Right now, at the artificially lower price, producers aren't going to be willing to supply the same quantities of milk, and consumers are going to try to buy more milk. So there's going to be a shortage. And so ironically, the government's going to be hurting the very people it was supposed to be helping. That now the poor mother, when she goes to the store, can't get any milk at all. Milk has disappeared from the shelves. There's a shortage of it. So even though if she could find it, it would be cheaper than it used to be, that's a little consolation to her, because some of these mothers now, when they get to the store, the milk's gone. And you have to like be friends with the dairy farmer, be friends with the grocer to be able to get the milk. You know, he'll get it and know in the moment. I'm sorry about the freezing there. The grocer will get the milk perhaps, but then know that if he puts it on the shelf, it's going to disappear in an hour. People are just going to load up on it. So maybe he'll call his friends, you know, or his favored customers or something and say, hey, we got milk in this morning. I'll keep some of it, you know, in the back for you. But, you know, I don't want to make a big scene. Just pull your car up around back of me. So that's the kind of stuff that happens when there's price controls, because, you know, the market price is not being allowed to do the rationing. That there's other things that come into play, and that's, you know, I'm not just making this stuff up. Like, I've seen this with my own eyes in terms of rent control of apartments and things like that. And I've heard people, I'll tell my quick little price control story about gasoline. So when I was teaching at Hillsdale College, I knew a professor there, and he said that he worked at a gas station in the 1970s when they had price controls. And he told me, you know, just one story he told about this in terms of rationing and stuff is he said that, you know, there'd be lines of people trying to get gasoline because, again, the price was too low. It wasn't clear in the market. And so they had to use some way of rationing. And the government had certain things about, like, what your license plate was. If it, you know, if it ended in an even number, well, then if it was a Tuesday, you could get gas. They had all kinds of weird arbitrary things like that. But he said another thing that they would do is, he said, yeah, like if there was a pretty girl driving a car, I'd make sure she got to the pump before somebody else did. You know, so that's the kind of thing that they know they don't have enough to go around, so they can't just sell it and let the market price weed out the people who really want it and don't want it. So then they have to use some criteria. And so, yeah, if you're a young teenage guy working at the gas station, yeah, one thing you might do is if you see a pretty girl driving a car, you might, you know, give her preferential treatment. And so I asked him, I said, is it true, what we're teaching the students here, when the government lifted the price controls, did the gas lines disappear overnight? And he said, no, they actually lasted about a week. But he said the reason is that the gas stations, at least in his area, were afraid of a public backlash, right? They didn't want to just raise their price the next day because then that would have looked, you know, greedy or something and their customers might have gotten mad. So they tried to, you know, so the federal government lifts the price controls, and he said that, you know, the gas station where he worked didn't jack up the price immediately. They waited about a week before they jacked up the price, or maybe they did it gradually. I don't know. So he said, yeah, it did take about a week for the lines to disappear, but he said it was because they kept the price at that low artificial level for a little bit so that, you know, so it wouldn't be so obvious that, oh, now the government's giving us permission, we're going to gouge you. Like, that's not the image the gas station wanted to give off. So as far as Ed's question now, he's saying this, I didn't finish that train of thought. So what Mises was saying is the initial price control is not enough. If the goal were to help poor mothers get more milk for their young children, you put that price control on milk, you've actually made things worse, at least for some of the young mothers, because now that milk has disappeared from the shelves. So Misa says the politicians at that point have two choices. They can either abandon that initial intervention and go back to a pure market economy, or they can go further. They can say, well, wait a minute, why is milk now in short supply? And they can go ask the grocers, and the grocers can say, well, look at the farmers are still charging us such and such per gallon on the wholesale side, so we can't, you're expecting us to turn around and sell it at a loss, so why would we do that? And so then the government says, okay, and they go to the farmers and they put price controls on the wholesale milk and say, you're not allowed to sell to the grocer for more than this amount per gallon. And then they think, okay, if we can hold down the wholesale price, now the grocer will be willing to fill his shelves up again and sell it at the controlled retail price. But of course, that just pushes it back one step. Now, the farmers don't want to make milk anymore. Now they can't, and the government says, why aren't you making milk? And they say, well, because look, you're not allowing us to sell it at a price sufficient to cover our costs, because we got to, feed the cows, we got to hire people to milk them, we got to do this and that. And so the government then can, again, abandon course, or it can intervene more and try to control those prices. So that's Mises' argument there, that it's a chaotic muddle to just have various interventions piecemeal, and that the logic of it leads the government step by step into expanding more and more until it eventually would stop in full-blown socialism, or in theory they could go the other way. But he's saying it's not stable to have just an interventionist state that's of moderate size, that it's going to go one way or the other. So Ed's question is, which of the two is the traditional medieval absolute monarchy? Well, it's, if I understand your question, Ed, I don't think it's not that the traditional medieval absolute monarchy is either pure capitalism or pure socialism. I mean, I would say it's neither of those. But it's, if you're saying, so which way did it move? Well, I think it moved towards socialism, right? I mean, just if you're saying in Europe, did they move towards socialism or away from it since the medieval period? I'd say they moved toward it. Right, so I don't know if I'm answering your question or if I'm saying what you want me to, but that's the way I would answer. So Mises is not saying at any given time, go look out at the world, and every government is either going to be, or every society is either going to be pure capitalism or pure socialism. That's not what he's saying. He's saying each of them is going to be tending towards one or the other, that it's not stable to be, a highly interventionist state, but just to, stay within your boundaries. And you can certainly see that in the United States, that, like, look what's happening in healthcare, for example. The government back in World War II put in price controls on wages and prices, and so then employers weren't able to attract high-quality workers because they couldn't offer them they couldn't offer them raises. And so what did they do? They started offering health benefits because that wasn't considered part of the wage. And then there was, the tax code got involved to exempt healthcare or health insurance premiums as part of your taxable compensation, and that sort of stuff gets in there, to the point where now people, their health insurance is typically tied to their job, as opposed to, your employer doesn't pay for your health insurance or your car insurance, but yet everyone thinks it's normal that your employer pays for your health insurance. Well, that very fact is part of the history of government intervention in the United States. And so then, of course, that leads to all kinds of problems. That's partly why medical expenses keep going up so much. And then because of that, people say, oh, we need to have reform. And the reform is never, let's get the government out of this. The reform is always, let's have more government intervention. And so we just keep getting closer and closer to the point where the government is just doing everything. Okay, Ed Farr says that, referring to the FDIC discussion, that, yeah, the Charles Schumer, and I don't remember the name of the bank, it'll probably come to me the moment we log off here, Charles Schumer arguably caused the failure of a particular bank in California, because he was talking about it had making risky investments or being on shaky financial ground, and then, people got worried and wanted to take their money out, and then that was the end of it. But the thing is, just to make sure you guys understand the Rothbardian the Rothbardian angle on this, because banks right now in our modern financial system operate on a fractional reserve system, they're all inherently insolvent. All right, so we can talk about, you know, is that technically accurate? I mean, there's a sense in which it is accurate. There's a sense in which it's not quite accurate. That, you know, if you look at the books, the way fractional reserve bankers do their books, their assets can exceed their liabilities, and so they have equity. But what Rothbard means is that their liabilities consist of demand deposits, where the customer has the contractual ability to show up and demand instant redemption. And so all the fractional reserve bankers' liabilities are, you know, very short term and instantaneous, if you will, whereas their assets are long term. So one of the principles of sound financial management is you want to match the duration of your liabilities and assets. So you don't want to have a bunch of short term liabilities and long term assets, because you might get caught and not be able to roll them over. And so if you understand that, like, so you don't want to borrow a bunch of money from people for a 1 year term and then lend it out to other people at a 10-year term. Because then when a year runs up, you owe these first group of people their money back, but the people you lent the money out to still don't have to give it back to you for 9 years. So you can get by if you roll that short-term debt over. If you go find some other group of people who are willing to lend to you for a year, you can pay off the first group. And if you can do that 9 times more, then you can be fine. And if, you know, if there was a spread on the interest rates that you were paying and charging, that can be profitable. So in a sense, that's what fractional reserve banking does, except the short-term nature of the borrowing, if you will, is instantaneous. Because the people who deposit their money with you in a checking account, they could show up and take it all out tomorrow. So it's not even just a 1 year loan, it's a, you know, a 1 second loan, if you will, that they're continuously rolling over when they leave money on deposit with you. So Rothbard's point is we shouldn't get mad, or, you know, it's this bogus frame of mind that leads us to believe that, oh man, that person badmouthed that bank, and so that's why it went under, and let's go punish that guy for speaking ill of the bank and causing a bank run. Rothbard's going to say, no, the reason there's a bank run is because the bankers were fools. They took in a bunch of money that they said was going to be available on demand, and they went and they invested it in stuff. They, you know, invested it in real estate or bought bonds with it or lent it out to somebody else. And so then if somebody comes along and just talks about this fact, and then people show up and want their money back, which the bankers agreed they would have ready for them, and now the bankers say, oh, well your money's gone because we lent it out because we wanted to make more money. And we're, you know, the villain in this story is the person who spread the rumor. Right, so that's Rothbard's take, that he would think that the idea that you can be prosecuted for causing a bank run is crazy, because all banks are susceptible to bank runs, and the only way to really solve that problem is to have 100% checking account balances, 100% reserves, that for demand deposits, if you give your money to the bank, they should just put it aside for you, just like if you. You know, we have storage facilities. If you're a college student and you want to go home for the summer, and you're switching apartments from, you know, semester to semester, you might have a couch and TV and lava lamp and some other stuff that you want to put in storage. And so what do? You put it in a little garage, you close it, padlock it, and you pay the owner a monthly fee for that service to store your stuff. And that's a perfectly legitimate business. Well, that's what banks could do in terms of checking accounts. That you have $1,000 in cash that you don't want to carry around in your wallet because you could get mugged or something. Okay, so you go to a place, you put it in a room, they close it and lock it up, and then you have access to it whenever you want. And you pay them a small fee for that storage service. And that's what a checking account would be in a Rothbardian world. And just like if the owner of the storage facility with your furniture started renting your couch out, saying, oh no, it's okay, I'll have your couch back when you need it, that would be crazy. Well, that's the way Rothbard, that's how he interprets fractional reserve banking. It's similarly crazy in Rothbard's mind. Okay, Brad says, related to your privatized banking book, when you spent time with one or two of the major life insurance companies, did you find them leaning toward Keynesian or Austrian? So if, to clarify for people, again, he's asking me about this book, How Privatized Banking Really Works, that I co-authored with this guy, Carlos Lara. If you Google it, you can find it. You know, it's online. And so part of what we discuss in the book is we are looking at a type of insurance and how, you know, that might be a good thing for certain households to do, with, you know, in terms of their financial planning. And so for part of the book, we went and we interviewed the personnel of some insurance companies. So to answer your question, Brad, they were... One group was explicitly Austrian. Like a few of the guys, you know, knew the name. And it was funny because some of them started, you know, one guy's like, oh yeah, Austrian. I go, yeah, like Schumpeter. Which, I mean, on the one hand, that's good, right? I mean, yeah, I mean, there's Schumpeter, some would argue, was an Austrian economist. But on the other hand, it was clear the guy didn't read Mises.org because, you know, that's not the first name you would throw out to identify with another self-identified Austrian in the American climate today. But they were certainly non-Keynesian. Like, they were real politically conservative. You know, oh my gosh, these massive deficits, what, this is crazy. Because this was right when the stimulus package went through, was when we were doing the research for this book. And so, yeah, they thought that was crazy. And, you know, and I was asking them about inflation. What, you know, are you guys worried about, you know, if you're sitting on a lot of bonds or something and then inflation kicks in, what are you guys going to do? You know, that kind of stuff. And they were very concerned about the whole situation. So they definitely were not Keynesians. They weren't thinking we need to spend, you know, the government needs to spend more money to stimulate. That's not at all what they thought, at least for one of the groups. I'm trying to think. We did two main companies that we interviewed. So one of them, for sure, like I said, the guys were pretty cool and anti-Keynesian and were, you know, big free market guys. The other group, I can't remember explicitly us talking like that. I think we were more with that group talking about the nuts and bolts of what we were doing the research on the book for, like as how, you know, policy loans work and things like that, and what they do with the money, the premium payments and all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, I would be stunned if those guys weren't pretty free market. But I don't know if they would call themselves Austrians. Some of them would, because it was a selection bias, too. I mean, we went to companies that were interested in the sort of thing we were writing about in our book. And the person from the insurance industry who was into this stuff was also a big fan of Austrian economics. So, I mean, it doesn't mean that most insurance people are Austrians, because the ones we were seeing, the only reason we knew of them is because of a mutual acquaintance who was both, you know, into insurance and also loved Austrian economics. So it's not surprising. But yeah, to answer your question, that's they were certainly non-Keynesian, and they at least knew of the Austrians and were sympathetic, but perhaps not personal, you know, avid readers of it. Okay, Ed Farr says, I think absolute monarchy is the ultimate end socialism eventually returns to, like turning back the clock toward universal slavery under the tyrant. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, Ed, I'm not too well versed in European history, so I really don't even know what I'm talking about. So I probably shouldn't say too much more. I would just caution you, terms like, you know, absolute monarchy and things, I mean, it made it sound like the king back then could do whatever he wanted. And I'm not sure that that's right. Okay. I mean, he may have said that, but I don't know if he could, you know, and maybe it was different in different countries and things, but like, I don't think a king could have come out and said, you know what, I'm declaring that Jesus Christ wasn't the Savior after all. Like, I think people would have said, no, you can't say, you don't have the authority to say that, you're wrong. You know, because back then they were people were fairly religious in those areas of the world, right? So, so again, even though they may have claimed that they had absolute power to do anything, I think the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century, I think those rulers had far more direct control over their subjects' entire lives than even the so-called, you know, absolute despots of the Middle Ages or the medieval period, or, you know, whatever you're looking at. But again, I can't start rattling off examples and say, you know, Louis XIV couldn't do such. I mean, because I don't know what I'm talking about. But again, I would just caution you. I think there were certain realms in which the king was supreme, but then there were other areas where it was just like everybody just knew that, no, you can't do that. You don't have the power to do that. Whereas that sort of this, those limits on the power of the state had been totally broken down in the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century. And that's actually, I think, what the term totalitarian means. It means that, like, it's total control. That it's not just that the political rulers have power on political matters, but, well, it is that, but that everything is political, right? So, like, you read 1984, part of why that's so ominous is that everything, from the moment you wake up till you go to bed, everything is political in that world. And so that's, whereas, you know, I think back in the Middle Ages, that there would have been realms of your life where, you know, no, that's, you know, politics doesn't involve this. That would be my very amateurish reaction. Okay, Ed Farr has another question. He says, more to the point of the discussion, I guess talking about banks, what is meant when Rothbard speaks of double ownership when banks lend deposited money? Okay, so here we're talking now again about fractional reserve banking. So this is a point that Rothbard makes, and Walter Block in particular nowadays is really forceful on this point. So, and again, for this class, you guys don't need to know this, for those tuning into this discussion. So what Rothbard means is, look, if I go to a commercial bank and I deposit $100 in a checking account, or what's called a demand deposit account, in my mind, that is still my money, right? I don't think that I just loaned the bank $100. I think that I gave it to them for safekeeping. In my mind, that money is there. If I can go to the ATM and print out, you know, what's today's balance and go look at it, and it will say $100 is in there. So I can go to a store and spend it. You know, I can go up and say, hey, how much does that cost? The guy can say, oh, that sweater costs $90. And I can say, I can afford to buy that because I have $100 in my checking account. All right, so I clearly still think that is my money, just as surely as if I had a $100 bill in my wallet. If I go take that $100 bill in my wallet and give it to the bank, and now electronically I think I have $100 in my account, to me those are indistinguishable. That's the same thing. It's just I've converted my money from one form into another, but it's still my money. It's my $100. So Rothbard is saying, but now under fractional reserve banking, the bank takes that $100, it only puts 10 in the vault, and the other 90 it goes and lends out to Joe Blow and puts it in his checking account, or physically hands him the green pieces of paper, whatever. So now Joe Blow's walking around town, and he goes and he sees a sweater that costs $90. And he says, you know what, I want to buy that because I have $90 in my checking account. Or he pulls out $90 in cash from his wallet and says, this is my money. I'm buying that sweater. Okay, so that's what Rothbard is getting at, is wait a minute, how can it be the case that both I and Joe Blow think we are full owners of that same $90? That doesn't make any sense. That there's something fraudulent going on there. So that's... Okay, and a little camera freeze. Okay, so that's what Rothbard means, Ed. And this also, this is what Walter Block deploys as his response when people try to say, well, look, it's not fraudulent, it's all voluntary, fractional reserve banking, that is. And you say, come on, you know, people in a modern market economy, they're not stupid. Everybody knows when you go put $100 into the bank that they don't just put it in a little drawer with your name on it, that they lend it out. And that's why the bank can afford to pay you interest, because the bank is making interest on its loans, or it's, you know, earning a rate of return on its investments. So you'd have to be a moron to think the bank is just burying your money in a vault somewhere and is also paying you interest on a checking account. If, you know, that's impossible. You know the bank's putting your money to work, as it were. So, and they said, if you want to really be clear about it, I mean, you know, what if a bank, even a totally libertarian world, the bank says, you make a deposit with us and we'll, you know, we spell it out contractually. We say this is, you know, we're going to do our best to have this money available for you when you show up, but it might not be available, and because we're going to lend it out. And so are you okay with that? And this person signs a contract, the banker signs a contract, so it's a voluntary transaction, everything should be great. What's the problem? And so what Block says is, well, you know, depending on exactly what it is you're doing, he said, the fact that it's voluntary that people sign contracts, that by itself doesn't make it okay, or doesn't legitimize something that is just nonsense on the face of it. This is the same token. I can pay you $100 to design a square circle, and we can even sign a contract saying, I'm going to pay you $100 and you're going to deliver for me a square circle, and you can sign the contract. Say, yep, I agree, I'm going to do that. But that doesn't mean you're actually going to do it. That's a nonsense contract. It's impossible to create a square circle. And so that's what Walter Block kind of thinks about using contracts to try to enshrine or legitimize fractional reserve banking. He's going to say, if it really is fractional reserve banking, where, you know, one person deposits his money on account and still treats it as his money, and then somebody else thinks that, no, the same bit of money is his money, he said, well, you can't have that. That doesn't make any sense. They can't both be full owners of the same thing. They could be part owners, but that's not what they think. When you go and buy the sweater, you think, no, I got that money in my checking account. And you show the guy the receipt, or, you know, show them the ATM balance. And the other guy with the loan from the bank does the same thing. So, you know, Walter Block's point is they can't both be right. They can't both be full owners of the same $90. That doesn't make any sense. Okay, we got about 7 more minutes, guys, and I'm going to wrap it up. Okay, Brad says, I'm thinking there is a high probability that the government will increase the requirement of life insurance companies to own government bonds. Then they will mandate that 401k participants have X percent of your portfolio in government bonds. With the feds currently buying 70% of bonds, these steps would help reduce the printing of money. So my question, if this happened, wouldn't the government be setting up life insurance companies for failure as well as 401k individuals if and when the dollar collapses? Okay, well, there's a lot going on in that question. So as far as 401k, you're right. And that's incidentally why Nelson Nash, the guy who's, you know, inspired the book that you've been reading by me and Carlos, that's partly why he urges people to adopt his message, because he's saying the traditional stuff that, you know, the experts tell you to put your money in, like a 401k, he thinks the government's coming after that first. That's like, you know, low-hanging fruit. That the government's broke. They've already floated trial balloons, by the way. You know, the government, when was this? This is a year or two ago. I can't remember exactly when. But they put out feelers about taking over retirement accounts and replacing them with government annuities. And then there was a backlash and people were freaking out. And so not only did they stop talking about that, but the news stories that reported it disappeared from their websites, right? I don't know if it was CNBC, but it was, you know, companies like that reported the initial thing where, you know, some government official casually mentioned that, yeah, we're toying with the idea of, you know, offering people the option, you know, people who are in 401k plans right now and don't like the volatility of the stock market, they can, you know, hand that over to us, the government, and then we'll replace that with a guaranteed annuity, you know, backed up by the full faith and credit of the United States government. So wouldn't that be much better for you guys? So now people trying to plan their retirement don't have to worry about 40% drop in the stock market like happened in 2008. They can know that Uncle Sam is there waiting to pay them, and they're, you know, they don't have to worry about it. So, of course, that sounded pretty scary to a lot of people. Look, the government was trying to take their 401k. And so, like I say, not only have you not heard that anymore, but the original news stories, like on CNBC, I don't know if it was CNBC, but it was something like that, that carried the reports of this. When you try to go email it to your friend, they say, wait a minute, that URL doesn't work anymore. And you'd go click on it and say, you know, this story is no longer exists or something. It's like, what? So anyway, they nip that in the bud. But that's the – so yeah, to answer your question, Brad, yeah, they could – whether they outright seize it or like you're suggesting, they could just put in more and more requirements to say, well, to be really safe – you know, these things have to own government bonds. And of course, what they'd be doing there was just rigging it so that now, you know, they could say like a mutual fund company or these other things to qualify to still be a tax qualified retirement plan. They have to have a larger allocation in safe securities, which just coincidentally would be, you know, treasury bonds. And so it would just be the government basically forcing people to invest more in treasuries or else the IRS will take more of your money, right? Because the way they would do it is say to continue to be able to invest this stuff, you know, with pre-tax dollars or have, you know, the special tax advantages of a Roth IRA or 401k, those things. You can't just invest it in, you know, some your buddy Billy Bob's entrepreneurial venture to go to the moon. You can't put your retirement account in that because the government's going to say, no, we don't know what that is. So there's strict limitations on the kind of stuff you're allowed to put your money in for your retirement to fall under the umbrella of a 401k and that kind of stuff. So the government, if interest rates start rising on government debt, one way they could push them back down is to pass these sorts of laws to force people into buying more government debt. Okay, so I mean, you're totally right, Brad, that could happen. It wouldn't surprise me. In fact, it probably will. Whether it's they seize it or they do that first, who knows? And yeah, they could do that with insurance companies too. Yeah, all it would need, the only pretext they would need is there's going to be another crash, which of course there's going to be another crash. I think it's going to happen soon, incidentally, with all the stuff Bernanke's been doing. And then in the ensuing chaos, the government's going to come and swoop in and be the savior and pass all sorts of regulations and do all sorts of new things to, you know, under the pretext of trying to ensure stability. And so you're right, since people think government bonds are the safest investment possible, that would be one pretty easy way they could do it, is they could force a lot more private sector institutions to take on government bonds to make their portfolios less volatile. That would be the official justification, even though the real justification would be, haha, now the government can borrow at cheaper rates for another few years. And yeah, you're right. If they did do that, then if and when the dollar collapses, well, is that right? I mean, the dollar collapse per se would affect all kinds of stuff, but if the treasury market explodes, well, then that would also, you know, probably bring down the dollar too, and what would certainly wreck people who are holding treasuries. Okay, well, why don't we wrap it up there? So thanks, guys, for tuning in, and I will see you later. This announcement for the – I have graded a lot of people's midterms. The reason I haven't formally announced that they're done yet is there was some kind of – quirk with Moodle, and people who needed their thing to be rescored because like one of the questions was wrong, their short answers got taken out for some reason, and so we're still waiting. So I can't tell you guys what the right answers were and the short answers, because some people still need to, we're working with them to get their answers back because they disappeared. All right, but if you want to go check your grade and it looks like you got credit on those things and it looks like you got, you know, credit on everything, that's probably going to be your final grade if you're curious. But again, I'll send out the email blast when it's totally official. Okay. Thanks, guys.